March 23rd, 1992, Dr. Terrell Gibson lectures Jung and the Mystical Soul of the West. This evening's lecture will explore Dr. Jung's profound impact on the recovery of ancient spiritual directive techniques in our era. Attention given to the provocative insights of living Gnostic and mystical expressions of the psyche. And we will also have some slides.
One of the great Hispanic poets of our era called Keeping Quiet, which seems to be, I think, one of the biggest things that Jung helped us learn is that the psyche does constellate if we can get quiet enough to hear it. It's here all the time and it's speaking to us. But she's kind of a shy creature and doesn't speak very loud if our ego life is really disturbed and anxious. So maybe if we can just use this poem as a centering koan for the evening. Now we will count to 12, and we will all keep still. For once on the face of the earth, let's not speak in any language, but stop for 1 second and not move our arms so much. It would be an exotic moment without rush, without engines. We would all be together in a sudden strangeness. Fisher people in the cold sea would not harm whales, and the persons gathering salt would look at their hands. Those who prepare green wars, wars with gas, wars with fire, victories with no survivors, would put on clean clothes and walk about with their brothers and sisters in the shade, doing nothing. What I want should not be confused with total inactivity. Life is what it is about. I want no truck with death. If we were not so single-minded about keeping our lives moving and for once could do nothing, perhaps a huge silence might interrupt this sadness of never understanding ourselves and of threatening ourselves with death. Perhaps the earth can teach us as when everything seems dead and later proves to be alive. Now I'll count up to 12, and you keep quiet, and I will go. Pablo Neruda. It's what I hope to do tonight. And I hope you in the back can see. This is about as big an image as I could cast of her. I want to start with just, again, a couple of quotes and a little opening vignette. I want to put up a model about C.G. Jung's contribution from my perspective to our understanding of the soul in the West. Kind of amplify the model a little bit, and hopefully we'll have time after the break to interact a little bit with that. Just three more quotes. To set the mood about this issue about Jung and the soul, and particularly as I've put in the advertisement, I'm interested in talking about, I'm particularly interested in mysticism and Gnosticism as an experience in the West and Jung's recovery of that. And the first quote just comes from Teilhard de Chardin, where he talks about spirit. Teilhard, an interesting man, a Jesuit priest that was a paleontologist and started coming up with some rather controversial theories about the relationship of spirit and matter. Now, it's very interesting that Teilhard was doing his work as Jung was working in the clinics in Zurich. Teilhard was working with old fossils and rocks and in laboratories. And Rome got threatened about this too much talk about connecting spirit and matter. It's really interesting that we've, in our official institutions in the West, we've been really concerned about dualism. But when anybody really starts talking about the mystical unism that exists in the universe of things, these institutions get all nervous. You probably heard the story. They decided a way to silence him. They sent him to China to some kind of mission, thinking that he'd get quiet and they would never hear from him again. And he got involved in a paleontology project there and discovered Beijing Man, which is one of the earliest skulls, and was put right in the middle of the international scientific controversy. No matter what they could do during his whole career, they could never silence Teilhard and his interest in the way spirit and matter interpenetrate each other in a very Jungian way. And he says, spirit is neither superimposed nor accessory to the cosmos, but that it quite simply represents the higher state assumed in and around us by the primal and indefinable things that we call, for want of a better name, the stuff of the universe. Nothing more and also nothing less. Spirit is neither a meta nor an epiphenomenon. It is the phenomenon. They are. Albert Einstein revolutionized the understanding of quantum mechanics and relativity. And I understand later in life, the thing I liked about him, apparently he did kind of Jungian amplification and active imagination just on his own. Apparently as he got older, he would doze about 10 minutes on every hour, they tell me, when he'd work on mathematical formulas. And he'd wake up embarrassed and just say he'd something like midnight go time, had been dozing. And he'd often solve these problems when he'd take these little mini naps every hour, every 60 or 90 minutes. But it's a wonderful quote about Einstein and mysticism. The most beautiful emotion that we can experience is the mystical. It is the sower of all true art and science. They to whom this emotion is known is a stranger, is as good as dead. To know what is impenetrable really exists, manifesting itself as the highest wisdom and the most radiant beauty, which our dull faculties can comprehend only in their most primitive forms. This knowledge, this feeling, is at the center of true religiousness. In this sense, and in this sense only, I belong to the ranks of devoutly religious people. And a quote from one of Jung's letters. God wants to be born in the flame of our consciousness, leaping ever higher. And what if it has no roots in the earth, if it is not a house of stone where the fire of God can dwell, but a wretched straw hut that flares up and vanishes? Could God then be born? One must be able to suffer God. That is the supreme task for the carrier of ideas. They must be the advocate of the earth. God will take care of herself. My inner principle is Deus et homo. God needs us in order to become conscious, just as we need limitation in time and space. Let us therefore be for God limitation in time and space, an earthly tabernacle. So spirit is not an epa or metaphenomenon. It is the phenomenon. Mysticism is the most beautiful and devotional emotion that we all can experience. And we are an earthly temple for the Imago Dei, the living mystical union of the universe. Three statements from three rather incredible minds of our era that I'd like us to kind of see as a proscenium to what we're going to talk about tonight. And a proscenium that I think Jung really believed in and had a passionate understanding for. I wanted to start with a vignette. Kate was telling me that she just hiked out at Lake Ozette over the weekend. Did the 9-mile hike. Some of you have been out there. There's two plank, 3-mile things, and you do the beach for 3 miles. I had a friend that was a macaw carver until he died about 3 years ago. He died at a fairly young age of brittle diabetes, which fairly common among us, among Coast Salish, I understand, because they lived on a fatty-rich fish diet, and then when the BIA started feeding them, we started feeding them all sorts of sugars and starches, and it actually became endemic, the amount of brittle diabetes, and actually created some inheritance problems in the tribe. My friend died real early, but he was the tribal carver, and part of his career, he was asked by the Maka to come out and teach them about carving again, he tells me. And so I knew he'd had some experience with these people, and you know from the Lake Ozette digs and the museum out there and some reading you may have done that they and the Nootka up in the Vancouver Island area were the great whaling traditions. They actually went out 20, 30, 40, 50 miles by dugout canoe to look for whales. And my wife and I took the West Coast Trail about 6 or 7 years ago, which is a wonderful trail in Vancouver Island. It's along the wilderness side. There are no roads on that side, on the outer extreme western portion of the island. It's about a 75-mile trail full of waterfalls and swinging bridges and wonderful beaches. We hiked in 7 miles the first day through the woods, saw some black bears, and heard a big herd of sea lions that were out there just, you know, through the forest. It's like Buddhist monks chanting. Some of you heard that, and it just fills the woods. We got out there, and we were setting up our tent, and my wife let out this kind of squeal of delight, which she can do like no other person. She has this wonderful... I know when she's delighted and when she's upset. It's a change in the pitch, but this was delight. And I turned around, and there were a bunch of these Great Pacific gray whales feeding on the krill shrimp, the mouth of this thing called Michigan Creek. And we were going to stay there one day, but we decided to stay 3 days because they just stayed there. And at low tide, you could get within 50 yards of these huge creatures. As they were just, and we had one of those rare occasions where we had good weather the whole time, and it was under a full moon, and it was just like an alchemical event in and of itself. And I was watching this, and I'd heard a little bit about the whaling, and I wondered, how in the world did it ever 8 people go out in a dugout canoe, and why would these whales permit themselves to be hunted by such a primitive hunting arrangement? So when I got back, I looked at my friend, who's the macaw, or the lummy carver, And at that time, I lived on Vashon. He lived on Vashon about 5 miles from me. It was a rainy night, and I went and knocked on Gary's door, and Gary was in there and invited me in. He was carving on a pole, and we had a cup of coffee, and we were just sitting and listening to the rain beat the windows. And I asked my question. I told him about my experience. I said, well, I know you work with the Maka. How in the world did they ever prevent themselves from being killed? You know, if I was a big whale and I weighed 80 tons and I had 8 folks trying to stick prongs into my hide, you know, I just wick them into the water and they dive hypothermia and that solved the problem. And my friend said that he had the same question. And when you go to Ozette, they've actually found where they've actually even dug places where they actually captured the whale. They drug it ashore, had these special channels dug and took care of the rendering on the shore. He says that he was told pre-contact that the Maka shaman would take, that were men that did the hunting, would take 8 men and ritually isolate them among the longhouses. And the longhouses could have no interaction with each other during the day and at night. And every morning the shaman would go and ask the crew person in each of those longhouses what they dreamed the night before. My friend says only on the day when each crew person had a dream of taking the same whale at the same time at the same place was the boat then issued from the shore. And they reported very little loss of life and reported incredible stories of coming out. Some whales would even come up and volunteer themselves. They say, not now, little brother or sister, next year you can sacrifice to the people so that when we die, we can sacrifice to you. And they would come and most often would find the whale waiting at the appointed place in the ocean at the appointed time, waiting for its appointed death. There was this sense of kind of a subspecies interpenetration and a dream connection with the whole biosphere. And my friend says he literally believes that's what happened. That there was some kind of sense of interconnectedness that was that profound and that moving. And I think it was Jung's life work to believe that all of us had active in us this imago Dei, this living splinter of divinity, that put us in connection not only with all of the collective experience of human beings, but the collective experience of all of the biosphere and the collective experience of all the cosmos, that we have that capacity for that kind of spiritual connection. That is my belief. And my belief that analysis is simply, and psychotherapy in this culture is so important, but it's a band-aid phenomenon because the great initiatory and religious and philosophical systems that used to function in the West are all dying right now. And psychotherapy is a band-aid attempt to preserve a living connection to that kind of living reality in our unconscious. And Jung is the son of a depressed Swiss Reformed pastor whose kind of patriarchal left-brain religion what didn't help bail him out of an early, probably stress-related death. A biological father that failed him, a Jewish father that he thought had an animated connection to the unconscious Sigmund Freud, but later got authoritarian. And I think Jung felt that he had, with his confrontation to the unconscious from 1912 to 1920, and his whole work after this with contact with the alchemical and mystical and Gnostic traditions of the West, that Jung really recovered for us pre-Reformation and still living sources of alchemy, mysticism, and Gnostic traditions to provide us this kind of ability to interpenetrate the great spiritual unity that exists across all the globe. And it's my belief, and I think that's what goes on in analysis. And I want to talk a little bit about that tonight, and I think Jung's contributions to that. This material is... I think it's also still very numinous. I'll bring this forward. I think it's very powerful and it's affecting our conscious. I had a strange thing happen. I won't read you. I was going to read the letter. My wife said, well, probably not. I was going to read you a paragraph. It was actually quite touching. While I was preparing for this talk and several others over the last couple of weeks, my wife and I occasionally have somebody come and help clean our house because we both get busy and we've both been out of town a lot. And so this person comes in occasionally. And I had books laying out like Jung and Tarot, Gnosticism, I had books on alchemical traditions, and I had Jung's Mysterium Conjunctionis laying on it. I had all these books kind of laying on my study. And when I came home, there was a little, really nicely written letter from this house cleaning person that saying that they could no longer clean our house because of the occult literature that was left laying around and quoted some Bible verses, quite concerned for the condition of our soul. It was not really an intrusive judgmental level. It was a letter that was really loving concern. I don't want to miscontext this, but I felt like it was a hostile thing. This person was quite concerned for the state of my soul because of these materials and the titles they laid on. The unconscious is still as powerful today as it was for the Salem witches and the things that they suffered in the Inquisition and the Crusades and that time of incredible mystical mysteries in Alexandria and Jerusalem and Athens and Rome from a couple of centuries before our current Judeo-Christian era to a couple centuries afterwards. I mean, it was an incredibly alive 4 centuries where people really got close, consciously close to this unconscious spiritual phenomenon that exists in our culture. And it's not something that happened long ago. It's still powerful, it's still luminous, and people still feel the pregnancy of that and the urgency of it and the danger of that. And this housekeeper felt the danger. She saw that material and got frightened, I think. She said, my goodness, there's something here that could bite me. I better get away. And so we're dealing with something that's quite numinous and very powerful. And in our time, I sense that what we've done is we've split our consciousness off from that because of our fear of it. And Jung noticed this, you know, probably 30 years before the major Roman Catholic churches and synagogues and mainline Protestant churches emptied out in this country back in the 60s and 70s. That was going on in the 20s and 30s. That people recognized that there was something, ever since Descartes went into the oven and decided he thinks, therefore he is, and he exists and he has being. And we created this incredible enlightenment, which has put people on the moon and has enhanced all of our life expectancies, double life expectancy of all the women in this room in just 90 years. It's done incredible things. But it's also created an alienation from this deeper spiritual impulse that is creating a real thirst and hunger. Back when I think I'd mentioned, even when we did the Fraser Ball films, The Way of the Dream, back 6 or 7 years ago when I was doing my thesis work, I got permission to get into the letter archive. I wanted to look at some particular Protestant theologians that were writing in my field. I'm interested in dialoguing with Jung about the recovery of soul in our time and realizing that Jung was really recovering living spiritual directive techniques in his analytic therapy that were really vibrant in the 12th, 13th, and 14th centuries of the Western era, and were eager, like him, to recover this and put it back to use inside our conscious experience. And they just handed me these letters, bulked by month and unsorted. So when you went through there looking for your particular person, I had to guess at when I thought they'd written you. There were all these unsorted letters. Obviously people in pain or had been in therapy with you or were interested in contacting you for therapy. And the names, the luminaries, the poets, the politicians, the religious leaders, all of the kind of stellar pantheon of that era, the physicists, incredible list of human beings who had obviously gotten hungry in the 1920s and 1930s to heal this rift because something in their adult experience had alerted them to the fact that there was something missing. And they hungered for that kind of holistic connection that apparently the Maka people had before white contact 200 or 300 years ago. To kind of put that thirst in perspective, I wanted to just read some brief... These are Japanese love poems written about the 12th and 13th century. Apparently, the high court in Japan, there was a brief period where it was almost a resurgence of Japanese feminism. And there were some women of letters and art that were as richly talented as any male samurai running around. And I want you just to listen. These love poems, I think, are really poems not just for the physical other. These are love poems addressed to the spiritual other, very much like the Song of Solomon within the Jewish and Christian tradition. You know, when I was a kid, my grandmother, she had the point-and-hunt method. Whenever you're having a problem, you sit around and you meditate on what the problem is. I grew up in the Bible Belt in the Midwest. She said, if you got a problem, you just go get it. She always told me, Terry, even if you're in a motel room, get a Gideon. And think what your problem is, meditate on it, then open the Bible and just let it flop open and point your finger. And read what's there. It's kind of interesting. My grandma had a little sense of synchronism. I mean, it was kind of a Midwest, Mennonite farmer kind of synchronistic understanding. So I'd always do that. And she'd always tell me, you'll always send it right smack in the middle of the Psalms, she says, which are real doctrinally sound. But I'd always do it and end up in the middle of Song of Solomon with all this really erotic, seductive literature. And she could never answer all my questions about what are all these love poems. Well, they were probably love poems of peasants, but they got enshrined in the canon because they recognized these poets also knew that it was a metaphor for looking for this greater other, not just in the outer world, but the hunger for the other that exists in our interiority that we're cut off from. This body, this is Ono no Komachi's poetry. This body grown fragile, floating, a reed cut from its roots, of a stream would ask me to follow, I'd go, I think. Think about wanting to be open to an invitation to unconscious. I think that's what people end up in therapy. The streams come along and says, do you want to go? And they say, sure. Sometimes they have no choice. The suffering is so great. Listen how quickly the suffering shows up. How invisibly it changes color in this world. The flower, of the human heart. Although I try to hold the single thought of Buddhist teachings in my heart, I cannot help but hear the many crickets' voices calling as well. Problem with kind of stilling the unconscious and focusing on one image that brings us to some depth. Undisturbed, my garden fills with summer growth. How I wish for one who would push the deep grass aside. As pitiful as a diver far out in Suma Bay who has lost an oar from her boat, this body with no one to turn to. The agony of the unconscious looking. I thought to pick the flower of forgetting for myself, but I found it already growing in his heart. In this world, love has no color, yet how deeply my body is stained by yours. My longing for you, too strong to keep within bounds, at least no one can blame me when I go to you at night along the road of dreams. We're going to talk tonight about that person that we go to along the road of dreams. Got to work back and forth here. May be hard to see. Might help if it's not superimposed. One of Jung's great contributions was that each of us had an individual myth. That somehow in us was a life story that connected our ego to what Jung called a self. And we'll see some charts about this. And Joseph Campbell, particularly in later life, became kind of a cultural guru about the importance of myth, and it talked at Eranos. Jung was sponsored, along with an Italian countess, a series of lectures every summer at Eranos, and Joseph Campbell had been a person that presented frequently there. And Campbell says that myth has three big, we all need myth, and we need an intact myth. We need some kind of story that connects us to the spirit of our being. It helps frames our need to transcend mortality, speaks of both the unity and the diversity of human experience at the same time, and it weaves the individual into the whole. That's even clearer. So the Jungian model, we're going to talk about the use of alchemy and Gnosticism and mystical frames. What Jung recovered, he said these are living kinds of traditions of our forebearer that helped us understand our life and our connection to life beyond our death, that we are part of something meaningful that transcends our own death. It'll help us deal with the fact that we both are a whole unism, and yet paradoxically there's a lot of diversity both in our own body and our experience, and somehow holds that paradox in tension. And one of the key things in Jungian theory, as most of you know, is this tension between the opposites, masculine and feminine, good and evil, earth and sky, that somehow Jungian psychology and individuation process attempts to work its spiral relationship across the tensions of those opposites. And that ultimately, this mythic structure will weave the individual into a whole sense of their being and purpose in this world. As I talk tonight, I also want to be aware of three kind of assumptions that I have that grow out of my work with Jungian. You'll see it through all of my stuff, and I just think I need to be clear about it. Three prejudices I have about Jungian thought is that I believe that Jungian work is primarily a psycho-spiritual essence, that Jung was interested not just in a psychology. Jung was one of the greatest living theologians in his time. As much as he made a disclaimer that I'm writing pragmatic, empirical psychology, Jung was really one of the greatest living theologians of his time. I think Answer to Job was a theological high point of his career and upset all of the great theologians in Europe. Any theologian that had any kind of zest left in his or her body was stirred up by Answer to Job. A very controversial piece to suggest that God needs us as much as we need God, and that God has got as much shadow as we have got a shadow, and that there's a mutual process of kind of therapy and individuation going on between us. Those are kind of provocative seed ideas that kind of put that into print, or even to rub up against that, or even to think about that out loud. Those are provocative ideas. But it's clear that Jung thought theologically. And I think Jung believed that all of his therapy was teaching people about the essential and natural theology that laid at their being. I think all psychotherapy in this culture is a theological enterprise. No matter what somebody comes into the room, I don't care if you're the most strict behaviorist in the world, and think that somebody comes with sexual dysfunction, you're just going to teach them how to do vaginal or penile exercises, and you're just a technician. But what people are really suffering from under that technical problem is they've lost the meaning of their own eros. And that therapy becomes a place, a container, where they can put their body back in connection with their spirit and find some meaningful connection that will give meaning to their life and help them transcend their own mortality, will help them to deal with their diversity as a unified whole, and will help them kind of frame their whole existence as meaningful. So you need to believe that when I work, and I think when you work, that he believed he was working on the psycho-spiritual essence of the human experience. The inherent feminist influence in my clinical worldview, and I think Jung would have probably moved this way had he been alive. There was a lot of sexism in Jung. He was a product of his age, but as a male, he was considerably more advanced, I think, than a lot of other male thinkers at his time. But I don't see any therapist can function now, having not been impacted by the feminist revolution and our understanding of the bivalent and bi-gender reality of the Imago Dei and the spiritual realities that are dealing with. And my sense of feminist, where it shows up for me, is I believe in the relational and interdependent individuality and uniqueness of every human being. We are unique and special, and we're interdependent with everybody else, and that there is the most important capacity we have is a relational capacity, relationship to our own interiority and relationship to the beloved other in our outer environment. And this is always preferred over dichotomization, rulemaking, and hierarchical modeling. And there are a lot of psychologies that are interested in rules and hierarchies and dominance and submission. I'm not interested in that kind of psychology, and I don't think that really works therapeutically. Clinically, people are after a relational and interdependent sense of their uniqueness that's meaningful and puts them into some kind of psycho-spiritual context to hold them. And I believe all psychic reality, and I believe Jung believed this, is mythic existential. That our reality is decoded by the meaning-making symbolic activity of what Jung called the other or the self, and we're going to see more of that, which precedes and encompasses both the chicken and the egg. We don't have to wonder which came first, the chicken or the egg. The self did. And I think Jung really believed that. We don't have to get caught in which came first, the ego or the self. The self did. The self is the total mystical encompassing package of the all. Now, a model, when I see people and when we're talking tonight, this is what I experience when people walk in. And I'm just going to go over this briefly, but when we deal with some of the subpoints, I want you to see that I think it's a dynamic model. I experience people's kind of pyramids when they come in, and we've all been trained to very carefully only show the ego part of our personality and the persona, the kind of mask. The mask of profession, the mask of a role, whether we're married or single or homosexual or heterosexual, or we're a psychotherapist or a doctor or a dentist, or we're an engineer, or we're a construction worker. All of those are persona qualities. And in this culture, it's kind of what I call a Tacoma or South Center Mall phenomenon. If you can't see it or buy it at the Tacoma Mall, it doesn't exist. It's really, you know, Wittgenstein back in the early part of the century went up to a Monte Cassino to write his Tacitus, to end all philosophy, and came back and said, I've got the answer. There is no God. There is no spirit. There's no epiphenomenal spirit. And there's only, you know, logical positivism was born. It was the final bitter fruit of the Enlightenment. If you can't experience with the five senses, or it's not a mathematical tautology like 2 and 2 = 4, it simply doesn't exist. You shouldn't waste any more time worrying about it. We'd become that skewed, and the ego had become that supreme as the only part of existence. And of course, Sigmund Freud recovered the personal unconscious. Sigmund Freud recovered personal trauma and the fact that all of us, everybody in this room, we were all primally wounded. It seems to be ordained, and why, we don't know. But there seems to be a necessity for all of us to be bitten by the snake in the garden. And in a feminist rereading of a lot of the gardens, particularly Genesis 2, the snake and Eve are the two heroes of that story. The heroine and the hero of that story is the snake and Eve, not Adam. That it was the courage to be willing to consciously eat the fruit of knowledge and consciousness and begin suffering that begins our growth. And we all are wounded. I would hazard to say everybody in this room suffered significant damage from the object relational research we have in the first 36 months that we've never recovered from. And it wasn't because our parents sat around and said, how can I really do my son or daughter in finally and completely? They are imperfect like we are, and they got anxious. And particularly about 18 months, most often the wound comes when we start separating from our parents. They've gotten used to us shoring them up. And when we start separating, we can't bear this thing that we're fused with from leaving us, and we begin to punish. And there's all sorts of unconscious sadism. All of us have been wounded. There's not a person that's escaped this. Some have been wounded more severely than others. Because we know these statistics are appalling. 1 out of 3 women in this room are victims of significant childhood sexual and physical abuse. And I think the statistics are high for men. But Freud recovered the fact that we have this repressed primal wound in us, and that it festers in the unconscious, and eventually, most of us are not lucky enough to make it till death without having to pay attention to it, thank God. And psychoanalysis became a way through association and dream interpretation to get back to that material and to pump it out. I think he saw it as a giant septic tank. And the psychoanalysis really was kind of the honeydew truck that came through association and pumped out all this psychic feces and cleaned out the unconscious. And then Freud being a ghettoized Jew that had lost his religious impulse. In fact, he sparred with it his whole career. You can feel his... I'm going back and rereading Freud. You can feel his attraction to it, even in his denigration of it. But he spent a whole career trying to debunk the official theology of his traditions, of Moses and Leonardo, and to talk about the psychological realities. But he basically said, you know, once you clean out the unconscious, if you're lucky enough to do that and recover this primal trauma and cathart it and go through it and go over and over and over again, work it through until you get all the junk out of all the corners, then if you just work in love, arbeiten und lieben, that's about all you can hope for in this world. It's basically a pretty dark, depressing, threatening, scary world. And there isn't anything beyond that. You got to live carefully and vigilantly. And if you got a job that you have Eros for, and you have a love relationship you have Eros for, that's probably about as much you can hope for in this world. Now, Jung came along and introduced, as we well know, and this is where the world of where these tools of Gnosticism and alchemy and mysticism become important. Jung started intuiting that there's something more in that. In fact, you know, 1900 was an incredible year. Freud actually wrote his Interpretation of Dreams in 1899, but he wanted it published in 1900 because he wanted it to be brought in the new century. William James wrote his Varieties of Religious Experience in 1900. Carl Jung was writing on the so-called occult phenomenon, working at the kind of mediumistic experiences of a relative of his. Incredible things were going on in a variety. It's like the 101st monkey, the unconscious, was rushing up and demanding to be seen again after 3.5 centuries of repression and the Enlightenment. And Jung read Freud's Interpretation of Dreams and was alive about this man's sense of the eros and passion of the unconscious, and they developed this relationship. And in the 12 intervening years, they went in radically different directions. Freud just wanted to ratchet down his theory tighter and tighter. And Jung started to say, you know, it's not a closed system. If you heard me, the Freudian system is a closed system. You know, garbage in, garbage out. If you had garbage in as a child, you get the garbage out as an adult. That's where the symptoms are. If you get a phobia or an anxiety or psychosis, you try and find out what the garbage is and you try to pump it out. It was kind of a psychic stomach pumping. But it was a closed system. Jung started intuiting that the system was more open than that. He, you know, the famous example was that schizophrenic patient, the Bergholzi, that you read about in the collective works. He must mention it, Louise is here, and Cato, I don't know how many times, but at least a half dozen times that this Francois Diderot, this archaeologist, had, you got really interested. These people were dreaming in mythic structures at night. And they look like the symbols match the great religious and psychological and spiritual traditions of the world. He wondered, they seem to be kind of universal. And the schizophrenic, I don't remember the exact thing, but you know, he'd haul him over to the window and ask Jung to squint and look at the sun and said something about, can you see the solar phallus is dancing in the solar wind around the solar disk, you know? And Eugene Bleuler was Jung's teacher at the time. And they really were trying to humanize and believe that schizophrenics were not speaking word salad, that it was something meaningful, and they were told to record this carefully. But you can imagine Jung, his pipe probably shifted rapidly from the left to the right side of his mouth as he wrote this down. 4 years later, this Diderot guy had been in the Valley of the Kings. I think the tomb of Seti I, one of the tombs that was found in the early teens. And this stuff had been buried at the time this illiterate schizophrenic had this vision, and suddenly Jung saw, translated 4 years later, something had been pulled out of the Egyptian desert just a year earlier. Diderot translated an ancient Egyptian myth about the solar phalluses dancing a solar wind around the solar disk. So Jung had a problem. How could an illiterate schizophrenic in a Swiss canton in the early part of the 20th century have almost an identical semantical kind of mythic vision that matched something been buried in the Egyptian desert from 4,000 years? Unless, you know, heresies of all heresies. We are not born blank plates, tabula rosa, which was the common psychological theory. That was the Freudian theory, and the American empirical theory was we're just born, our psyches are just this blank plate that everybody starts scratching on when we're born. And that we're filled with the impressions of our own lifetime. You know, Jung would never say you can inherit this stuff. Because there was a technical thing called Lamarckism, that if my mom or my dad gets conscious in their lifetime, you can't pass that on to your germplasm, and I can't inherit it from you. Well, I think Jung figures you can. I mean, but I think he really believed you inherited an entire set of the psychic images of the psychospiritual history of the whole biosphere when you're born. An intact library, an archival library with you, if you will, when you're born. And he called this the collective unconscious. Later changed the term to the objective psyche. I think partly he didn't want his movement to be confused with collectivism or communism. But he also wanted to sense that the objective psyche was something substantial. It wasn't just a mystical notion. It had substance. It was an objective other that was beyond me and my personal experience. And what Jung discovered in working with people, particularly in these two essays in Analytical Psychology, if you've read it or if you want to read it and want to spend some time, Jung kind of draws a blueprint of what happens. He says this blueprint won't always happen in just this way. But he suggests the kind of archetypal dominance that his career experience had suggested to him. And these are all familiar. You know, he says most often, but not always, the gateway is the shadow. That the way we pay our psychic dues if we're going to enter the unconscious is we have to recognize our own unlived life. Not only our unlived darkness. I don't think anybody in this room really has any problem knowing that if any of us push far enough against the wall, we are rapists and murderers and genociders. I mean, you all remember Sam Peckinpah's film Straw Dogs? You know, this kind of nebbish MIT mathematician that pushed by circumstances, these brutal sodomizing men in a Scottish village turns into this successful hunter and slayer of other human beings. You may have seen that. And at the tail end, going out after he's killed these men that are threatening him under a full moon, flushed with this frenzied, gory, psychic goriness, saying, I did it. This kind of ecstasy of kind of darkness that he discovered. You would believe that all of us in this room have that kind of capacity. I mean, that kind of rage given a collective reification is terrible. We all were part of a culture that incinerated with incredible gas bombs 150,000 peasants just a year ago in the Middle East. And these, as far as I can tell, most of these were not even the Republic elite guard. These were peasant conscripts. We knew that. They were forced by Saddam Hussein, jammed between two great cultures that had gone psychotic. And we as a whole culture gave permission for that just 14 months ago. Some people say the death toll may be over 200,000. And many of us in the room were disturbed about it, but we as a culture participated in that. You know, Jung stood on the edge of the Nazi Holocaust. The shadow's a big thing. You know, one of his most persuasive arguments is that the Holocaust happened because the whole German nation went into a shadow trance. And they lost their sense of boundary. And this unconscious, that, you know, the ancient, botanic, primitive, pagan material seized them and possessed them. Then Jung said, if you want to pay your dues, and the good sides of the shadow are even harder. I find the people I work with and myself, that's the easy part of the shadow. The other part of the shadow is discover that we have great gifts and capacities that we have not responsibly used in this world. And we're afraid of using those gifts because we're afraid of the responsibility that gift will entail on us and the suffering that using that gift. I really believe that every human being, I don't care how developmentally disabled, insane, crazy, whatever, every human being has an artistry in them and has a special contribution to make to this kind of culture. And that's often the harder part of the shadow to get to when people enter the process, is to claim their unlived gift of life. But Jung says that's the doorway. You know, that you got to pay your dues there before you even get, you know, that's the introduction. And then Jung introduced this anima and animus, which is a very controversial thing. I got into describing the feminine side of a man's unconscious, the anima, and a masculine side of a woman's unconscious, the animus. And I suggested both at the Way of the Dream Summit, I'm going to suggest tonight, that a lot of thought in Jungian community is getting a lot less worried about the male and female, and really just interested in the animated other that lives in our unconscious that shows up when we start doing our deep work, and it acts as a kind of a medial guide. You got to be careful. Ego's got to be discerning. Sometimes these guides are tricksters, and they got some negative aspects to them. There are witches and warlocks in the unconscious. But if we're careful about it, these medial guides, these animated beings, Jung's Mercurial and Philemon figures, can lead us through. He had these wonderful mandalic images, the round images, the spirit images of the divine animated unconscious, the quaternal images, the whole numbers, the sevens, the twelves, the sense of these whole metaphors, the psychic whole, can lead us down to the bottom of the unconscious, what Jung called the self or the imago Dei. This living integrator, this organic, living, live integrator of wholeness that exists at the bottom of our unconscious. The imago Dei is the self. And it gets more complicated than that. You know, just to show you, when I work with folks and how this works, and I won't spend a lot of time on this, but if it's true for one, it's true for everybody. There are growing numbers of analysts, by the way, that are interested in working not just with individuals and in our type of way, they're interested in working with couples and families. Because if the objective psyche exists, then not only do I have dreams alone, I dream of my family dreams of me. Our dreams interpenetrate, our spirituality interpenetrates. And what better way to get everybody together at the same time? Sometimes under some circumstances. But you got the personal unconscious in both people. You've got Jung talked about complexes. You know, we all have been wounded by life, and Jung felt that the unique way we've been wounded, there are these kind of dark asteroids, these feeling-toned asteroids in our unconscious called complexes. These original primitive traumas are there, and then every time we're traumatized later in life, it just adds energy and power to these great floating centers. They're like giant psychic black holes. And they have a personal face. They're related to my personal mother and father complexes and inferiority and power complexes. Those are common words that have been introduced from this Jungian concept. But if you allow yourself to surrender and the ego can stay conscious, you can actually be sucked through those complex black holes into the archetypal side of that. And the complex has actually become a gateway to the deeper spiritual unconscious if the ego can stay non-reactive and alert and present and work it through. That's individuation. So we got these complexes that exist to mediate the shadow between the personal unconscious and the collective unconscious, and eventually moves us through this objective psyche, always trying to reconnect with the self that exists not in just me. There is a self that exists in the whole universe. You know, I've told a story, but it to me is a wonderful example of how technology meets the self. Some of you may know Matt Fox, who's one of kind of the living Roman Catholic contemplatism in our time, and he's done a lot of literature, and he's a Dominican, and he was silenced 3 or 4 years ago. Rome said, we don't want you to write or talk for a year. So he didn't write or talk. He just went and hung around even more radical people for a year and pumped up on more radical ideas and came back and even wrote more radical stuff. I mean, that's, you can't turn it off once you get started. The guy says he's had his bag packed, ready to leave if it comes necessary, the Dominican order. But he got interested in this Hildegard of Bingen, this woman 8 or 9 centuries ago, great mystic feminist, who even lectured the Pope, if you can imagine that, in that kind of patriarchal era. Lectured the Pope when he became a bad boy and kind of talked to him about, kind of pulled back his martialness and his anger and his masculine intolerance. And she was a great mystic. In midlife, had a series of very powerful dreams called a little aphorism, and we're talking about who dreams who. And you think about the Makah and those whaling crews, and think about families dreaming each other. A 6-year-old girl dreamed she was with her grandmother. In the dream, she said, "Grandma, I can make myself disappear." "Nonsense, child," the grandmother replied. "Nobody can do that." At that point, the child woke up, sat up in bed, looked around the darkened room, then lay down and went back to sleep. As sometimes happens, she re-entered the same dream, whereupon the dream grandmother looked at the girl and said, "Lord, child, how did you do that?" So, okay. And it wasn't a failure. That's a great... And we're getting into alchemy. Here's something from the alchemical, you know, again, these seminal years, 1900. You know, all of this energy, the unconscious just blows out, starts showing up people interested in it. The 1946, 45, 46, the Dead Sea Scrolls buried for millennia to show up after we incinerate Nagasaki and Hiroshima and 13 million innocent people are slayed in German Holocaust ovens. This stuff shows up. Then a bare 6 months later, 52 books in 11 codexes show up at Naj Hammadi up on the Upper Nile. Documents that we'd heard about primarily through Orthodox Gnostic haters, people that drove these people underground, burned their libraries and destroyed their communities, and told us their perception of it. And even some of the brilliance of that work still lived. Jung didn't have access to most of this material discovered in Naj Hammadi. He had access to these Gnostic haters and their translations. And Jung was able to see the light and cipher through it. Even with that, there was some. And in fact, one of the beautiful things, that one of the books that came out of it, if you ever get a chance, Stephen Holler has written several books about Jung and Gnosticism that are excellent. But in 46, these documents come out of the Egyptian. What we discover, some of these people were crazy. There's the crazy dualist Gnostics we all thought they were. I mean, where there were these Sethians and Orphites. There was one group that worshipped, and the high point in their worship was they had the Eucharist. Like a little literal dualistic craziness here. They'd milk men of their semen and milk women of their menstrual blood and mix it into the Eucharist bread, and they ate it. That's kind of crazy. I don't think I go to a group. That's a little literal to me. But some of these groups were pretty wild and crazy. We got wild and crazy things happening in this culture now. But some of the groups had some of the sweetest, most pure, non-dualist recognition of the essence, the phenomenon of spirit that has ever been written. There's one of the books called The Gospel The Gospel of Thomas, G-O-T, The Gospel of Thomas. Guy's name, Giles Quispel, was a Dutch scholar of Gnosticism. Through a whole series of kind of uncanny interconnections, able to buy one of those with Bollingen Foundation money and present it to Jung on one of his octogenarian birthdays, and it became the Jung Codex. An agreement was that they would publish this text, and then they would return it to the Egyptian government, who wanted to get all these texts eventually back into Egypt, understandably. And it is one of the most sweetest, it's a Valentinian tradition, non-dualist. And what we discover from these communities, they were feminist. Men and women had co-equal positions of leadership and participation. They were grassroots communities that said, we don't want hierarchies. The minute you start getting an institution, you start forming IBM, and the minute IBM comes into existence, people get depressed and lose soul. They were pretty smart. And the third thing they said, above all, scripture is not as important, and dogma not as important as people's living day-to-day experience of the imago Dei or the divine that lives in them night-to-night, day-to-day, moment-to-moment. Remarkable communities. But here's a little passage from the Acts, the Apocryphal Acts of John. Grace dances. I will play on the flute. Everyone dances. Whoever does not dance does not recognize what is taking place. It's a wonderful literature. Let's look at the implications of this model now, particularly around mysticism. Some Jungian convictions about the Western soul a la Terry Gibson, but I think a lot of folks would agree with this. The psyche, that whole structure of conscious and unconscious, overlooked by the totality of the self. The psyche is inherently Gnostic, alchemical, and mystical in its pragmatic function. And I'm just going to make these statements, but first we're going to run through a slide series of some of a client's drawings. And then you all are going to be analysts and kind of look at that with me. We'll look at probe out some of the Gnostic material. But I just want to make those statements. The psyche is inherently Gnostic and alchemical and mystical and working out its prospective destiny. The psyche leads. To use a word, the biggest theology right now is process theology. Folks are saying that the Imago Dei, very, very Jungian idea, these process theologians looking at new quantum mechanics and physics and looking at new scientific data, says that the Imago Dei is constantly inside spirit and matter, luring us on to a more whole and perfect destiny for ourselves, individually and collectively. And one of the words they'd like to use is that this Imago Dei, it doesn't tell us what to do, but it does lure us. It winks at us. It calls to us. It plays the flute to us. And I think Jung believed that there was this prospective destiny in all of us. Look at the pyramid model in your mind. Talk about getting the ego to the self, what Jung has called the ego-self axis. And the whole goal of life is to individuate or to move ourselves, eventually to get a kind of a going DNA kind of spiraling conversation between our consciousness and unconscious, as alive as what happens in every cell of our body and what happens in the corpus callosum between the left and the right brain, that the ego and the self could have that kind of dance going on with an individuating flute playing in the background all the time. That's the goal. And to do that, we all become aware of a unique destiny. You know, I don't worry too much anymore about that free will or predeterminism. I used to worry about when I was a college kid and worried about philosophical issues. Some level, the deck is genetically stacked at birth. We know some of us have got that kind of bad cholesterol in our system. There ain't nothing we can do about it. It's just going to build plaque. And I may, those of us that got it may die younger than those of you that don't. It's the luck of the genetic cards. And some of you can curl your tongues and some of you can't. That's just stacked in the genetic code. Some of that's given. But I am comfortable believing that if whatever life, whatever destiny, psychic destiny, we all have a river channel. We all start up in a glacier of being somewhere, and we all have a delta waiting for us. And we have choice about whether we'll make it all the way to the delta of our existence with a sense of conscious wholeness and participation, or we'll die prematurely early of a stress-related illness. We can choose whether we're going to individuate or not and participate in the kind of mystical fulfillment and expression of that destiny. So I don't get too caught up about it. It's both and. It's not either or, whether free will or predeterminism exists. And I think Jung believed that there was a prospective destiny that calls everybody. The psyche teaches and provokes through experience and not dogma or creed. Jung valued dogma and creed. He said for the average person, afraid and tentative about their existence, and at times when we're in real trouble, dogma and creed are kind of summary statements about the best that Jewish and Buddhist and Christian and Lakota Sioux people have remembered. They all have, great religious institutions have a creed and a ritual. And we need that for protection. The unconscious is a powerful place. But we can only use that as a way to kind of reassure and calm and focus us. But those never become a substitute for a living encounter for the living Imago Dei that dreams in us and encounters us every night. It can never be a substitute for that. The psyche reveals, its archetypal core through image. And I want to tell a story about the psyche teaches and provokes and reassures through experience, not dogma or creed. And it reveals its archetypal core through image and connects us to the world. A couple of years ago, one of my favorite examples of my personal life. How many of you know about the Asarco plant in Tacoma? The Asarco plant in Tacoma. We used to have a plant down in Tacoma that cranked out 280 pounds of raw cadmium, arsenic, and lead every year until 1988. Huh? Good old Rustin. Until 1988, cranked that area 280 tons of this garbage. And school kids would breathe it down at the bottom of the stack. And it's terrible. Back in 83, I used to drive home every night, and I believe literally you could drive, they have a little tunnel, the road goes under this ominous stack where this stuff is spewing. It looks like the stack of Dachau. I mean, I learned to kind of hate this thing after time. But every night, the Nile's a great thing. To get to my ferry, it was 10 minutes faster if I'd take Ruskin Way and drive under this stack every night and get to the Vashon Ferry and get home. One night, Penny Matthews, one of my colleagues, and I were driving in my little old Mazda, and I'm always driving late, and I'm waiting. When you live on Vashon, it makes a lawbreaker out of you. I mean, it's just when the ferries are certain set times, and you learn how to shave it just real close. And I knew exactly 39 miles an hour down this curve and 41. You get to time it just right. And woe be it if you step out in front of a Vashon commuter car at the wrong moment. But racing, and we suddenly come, and the car goes at an angle about 20 degrees. And we went over about, there's a big gray pile of junk in the middle of the road. Pull a car over, go inside, and here's one of the things, it was a mother nursing her baby, and she and her baby were covered in this gray ash. And there were a bunch of people, about 20 people, but cars had gone before us. There'd just been this big dump of this stuff all over their cars while they were going through the tunnel. And we came about 5 minutes later. Got in there, and the mill manager just said, "It's just dust, why don't you all go home?" You know, I don't think the guy was evil. I think the guy was terrified. Some people got scared. Some people just started grabbing phones and calling the Puget Sound Air Quality Control people in the hospital and the sheriff's department. And it was really, it's like Rod Steiger was directing. It was like heat of the night. There was this kind of, Ruston's police are owned by the mill, essentially. And I remember this guy coming up poking his, kind of overweight. He looked like a southern sheriff poking his
You people better get home. You're causing trouble.
Well, the outer folks came, and what we discovered, they quickly analyzed and found out that there was 70% arsenic content in that dust. And everybody needed to go to the hospital, and they were going to do blood draws, and were particularly worried about the infant. Having a mild case of hypochondria that not even 14 years of analysis had made a dent in. I was left here concerned about how close I was going to be meeting the end of my delta, whether I was going to meet my delta. And I decided to stay with my colleague, and my wife came in, and I was kind of nervous. And I want you to think about teaches and instructs through experience. I was enraged. One of the things I was scared, alternating with images of enragement. I was enraged. Imagine taking a shotgun. What kind of violent primal fantasies and blowing this guy away. I'd never had such primal adult fantasies before. I was that angry at this man, the mill owner. And what's the instruction? So I go to bed and I have this interesting dream. It's about the power of this image to address us directly out of our experience. And when I split. I was 18 months old, and whatever abandonment, annihilation, fears that I was wounded with then, boy, the whole universe had abandoned me, was out to kill me. I was going to die. I was scared. I didn't know. All the primal stuff. I was a little 18-month-old baby. And in the dream, I was at that exact site where the Asarco Mill is. And if you know the place, it's right next to Point Defiance. It's one of the most beautiful places on Puget Sound. One of the most beautiful. It's interesting where we build our poison factories. I mean, we right there in this most beautiful site on Puget Sound. Only my dream was carved out like a giant rock quarry, and I clearly had got a bunch of people stuck down at the bottom somehow. We were marching on this rock quarry or something, and we got at the bottom and we could not get out. The sound was beautiful. It was a full moon, but we were stuck. And only in the logic of dreams, I suddenly knew I was supposed to line everybody up, and since I had led us into here, I was going to have to lead us out. And the way I would get out is we get in a line, we faced west, and then I was just supposed to wait for the next thing. The next thing is a giant trapeze bar just drops, clunk. And only in the logic of dreams, I knew I was supposed to grab the trapeze bar and hang on. And before I knew what was happening, I'm 100 feet off the ground, 150 feet off the ground, and I'm starting to get panicked. This is kind of scary. And I look up, and there's this guy who looks like Orville or Wilbur Wright. And it's a giant hang glider, and he's got a white suit on and goggles, and kind of this blonde hair and this wild look in his eye. And he looks down and winks at me. He tells me not to worry. He's Jesus Christ. And he's just got this hang glider and would I like to take a trip. And so I'm flying, hanging with this thing. And I take a Mary Poppins trip over all of the Puget Sound. And we nip and tuck over Vashon. Takes me up to my favorite kind of promontory of Mount Rainier and gently lets me down. And it's really clear that he's going to get the other folks. And the light is coming up in the east. And it's clear there's a trail. I need to head east. And it's real clear I need to forget whatever that was behind me and let it go. The psyche speaks every night and teaches us and instructs. And I had an interesting instruction about my primal abandonment complex and my kind of rage and father complex as an instruction about how letting things go and just surrendering. I'm learning that there are these wonderful hang gliders that fly around in the psyche. If you're willing to kind of, even in the midst of crisis, images have that kind of powerful, and you can believe that's a simple example that can get much more touching and profound with kind of patient work over time. The psyche counsels a paradoxical attitude, a hermeneutic or interpretation of both suspicion and affirmation regarding the real world. And I talked there about somebody named Peter Holmans, who's a theologian, has done a lot of work on Jungian psychology. Individuation, this ego-self axis, is the central ethical imperative for everybody. Each one of us. The central ethical imperative we have is to be responsible for our shadow and to take responsibly interact with ourself and to listen to what the unconscious tells us about what is true, good and bad, and true and unjust. And we need to learn and work that through. Story. 8 years ago, Zalman Schachter, who is this, he's a Hasidic rabbi who hangs around with Christian charismatics and Islamic Sufis and is interested in religious ecstasy. It's been kind of a lifelong image of it. I first met Zalman Schachter. He and I were going to do a workshop together, and he told me to pick him up at the old Battleship Missouri used to be over in Bremerton. And I was to pick him up in the Battleship Missouri parking lot. And I said, well, how will I know who you are? And he says, don't worry, you'll know who I am. And he says, I'll stand out. So I go there at 7 o'clock in the morning. Workers are coming, and this beat-up old kind of 1960s hippies love band drives in an old VW. And out comes this roly-poly rabbi with a U.S. Army ammo canvas bag around his waist with long, flowing beard. And I knew that was Zalman Schachter. So I went up and introduced myself. And I just watched him do this wonderful weekend. And he pulled out incredible delights out of this bag. He had ritual objects and incense, and he had quotations and holy books. He was just wonderful. And he stayed at our house, and every morning he'd go and do his ascetic rabbinical stuff. He'd get up at sunrise out on our porch looking out over East Sound towards Rainier, and he'd put on his little phylacteries, their little, get the little prayer things wrapped in there, and these little armbands and armies, and he'd do his morning prayer. And in the bottom I saw this shawl, this beautiful shawl that was the bottom, and I was fascinated. He never pulled it out. And we went through 3 days together, and he never pulled it out. And I finally asked him, what's the shawl? And he pulled it out, and it was just this wonderful white silk shawl. And it had little colors across it. Seven or eight bands, bright color, different colors. First band, it had a little bit of skin in it. And he says, when I was born, my mother stitched this. This was my birth color. And this was a piece of the umbilical cord in my foreskin that she sewed into this color. Every day I do my prayers alone. I put the shawl on. The second color, he says, this was my bar mitzvah color. And I stitched that on the night before I was given to the deeper mysteries of my Hasidic tradition. And I discovered that God lived in my testes and in my heart. The guy kind of talks earthy this way. Then he goes on and he says, this was my wedding color. And my wife and I stitched this together and hung it over the wedding bed, and it saw everything during the whole honeymoon, and it just hovered on that bed. Here's the birth color for my first child, a little bit of her umbilical cord, my first daughter, my second child, my son, my third daughter. And there was space right at the end. He says, this will be my death. This will be the place where my family will gather and stitch my death color. And they'll wrap me in my prayer shawls, and they'll put me back in the earth. That prayer shawl to me is a wonderful statement about the ethical imperative of growing consciousness across the life cycle from birth to death. And the responsibility we have to consciously attend to the spiritual meaning of our existence, our own interiority and its interaction with other people. And I think Jungian analysis teaches us all the kind of, out of our traditions, whatever our psycho-spiritual traditions, you finish a good analysis, maybe you finish a good prayer shawl. You learn to get this contemplative garment woven. The self is the divine splinter in each person. It's that living imago Dei that I talked about earlier. I had a client once. She was English. Worked with her back when I was in Boston during my early training. A woman who, during the Blitz, was a child of only like 5 or 6 years of age. And she had a lot of traumatic nightmares of just a heartbeat. We never could figure that out. It was just this booming sound. She didn't know it was a heartbeat. It was a booming sound and night terrors and kind of Nazi, blunt-faced, intruding figures raping and mauling her unconscious night after night. When she came to therapy, she was in midlife, suffering with some career and vocational depressions. And a sense that she had no spirituality. She had nothing that she believed in. Her parents had died. She'd suffered several divorces. Her life felt empty and flat. But she did have the combination of that depression, these nightmares that brought her into analysis. And later, by doing some kind of what Jungians would call active imagination, she was able to interpret that heartbeat, or that booming sound, as the heartbeat of the nanny, who, when the air raid sirens would go off, took her into her arms, took her down into the bunkers, held her close to her, and her nanny was frightened too, and she remembers the thumping of that nanny's heart. And her terror she caught. And so she remembers being down in those concrete tubular bunkers in London. She remembers the racing heart of her aunt. So she was in therapy for 3 or 4 years. One of the dreams she had near the end was a wonderful dream, talking about reclaiming the Imago Dei. Didn't have much kind of conscious adult spiritual experience or liturgy at all. She had a dream that it was back during the Blitz. She saw the Messerschmitts lacing the night sky with tracer fire. She felt the infiniteness of the night sky. and felt a strange kind of attraction to it. She said even in the dream it was beautiful, even though she knew it was dishing out death. And in the dream, somehow, she knew there was an advancing army behind her, but if she could swim across this river, she'd get to safety. So in the dream, she's in a river. She's running into bodies, babies, older people, her former husbands, her mother and father, everything that had died in her life, she ran into in that river. At times, someone would try to hold on to her and drag her down in this dark, cold river current. She kept swimming. She felt like it was all night long. Got to the other side, pulled herself ashore in the basement of this, like, blown-out church structure. Groped her way through the underchambers, the clerestory understructure of that church. Found some stairways, got up into the upper part of this blown-out church, and she heard this resonant chanting. She said it was a combination of Buddhist and Native American and Gregorian chant all at once by feminine voices. And then she saw some light over at the far end of what was a burnt-out, had been the burnt-out altar place. She walked up to there, and there was this absolutely pure crystal goblet with this feminine figure that was just kind of rotating inside the cup. And the cup itself was doing that singing. And the dream ended with her just having a contemplative image of what she called the singing chalice cup. That's as pure an image as I've ever... You could imagine a therapeutic experience of the self-constellating out of the kind of burned-out rubble of her life. The still, live, still quiet voice of this Imago Dei that's living in her and the assurance of the vibrancy of this deep feminine spirituality that was in this woman. Now, one last thing, and now I'm going to show some client slides, put up one more chart, and we'll be done. The opposites. Remembered earlier, I said the tension, that pyramid, the way we work to the self is, it's a spiraling tension between masculine and feminine in both its positive and negative aspect, between the good and the bad aspects of the shadow, between earth and sky, between ourselves and other, between ourselves and the divine. It's the struggle. We're spiraling, always working with this mysterious other. The tension of the opposites. The dance of the opposites. Some of you, you ever seen a film called Requiem for Faith? Houston Smith was given permission by the Dalai Lama just before the Chinese took over in Tibet in the late 40s to film a color film called Requiem for Faith. It was the last time, I understand, the monks actually used their own little temple inside the lamasery. And at the tail end, he actually records him with that wonderful, that Tibetan Buddhist, where they can make three notes, each man, with a vocal cord at once. They don't have the... It's just a wonderful resonant sound. But he shows their hands, and in one hand they've got a scepter, and in the other hand they've got an orb. And while they're doing this resonating, you just see these hands doing this incredible ballet. And Houston Smith, very near the end of the film, has this wonderful thing. He says, this is the eternal dalliance of wisdom with method. The dalliance of masculine with feminine, earth with sky, good with evil. And it's in the middle of that dance that the flute of the kind of mystical union, the mystical wholeness of the self pulls us together. And the opposites are the engine that fuels that process. The case. I'll get my chart so we can return to this. What I want you all to do, where'd it go? While we're looking at this case together, is just think about it. Now, I'm going to convince you all that you're good Gnostics and mystics. How are we doing on time? 9:10. I think we'll make it. Case real quickly. I've shown these before, but it's a wonderful case. I've been given permission. I've had this for a long time. And it's one of the most remarkable examples of the constellation of this material. From somebody, if I were to present 10 folks, this woman would have been voted least likely to have archetypal experience or alchemical experience or mystical experience. It's back in Boston, referred to me by a community social service agency. The woman weighed 340 pounds. I was dabbling with hypnosis at the time. The social worker, in good conscience, made the referral, but basically the instructions were, this woman, we've tried everything, she's not losing weight, she's nearly a cretin on the intelligence scales, but her weight's way out of control, we want you to do a little hypnosis and burn off a little fat. That's all the hope we have for her. Just put her out and give her some kind of induction. And that was kind of quick and dirty. Cared about her, but they'd given, clear too in the referral, they'd given up on her. I worked in a pastoral counseling setting at the time, and I was up in an upper offices, and the secretary buzzed me, and I could tell the secretary was just nervous. You know how sometimes people make people nervous? Gave this woman, I'll call her Barbara. Barbara's on her way up. That gave her instructions. So I went out to greet her. There's this woman. She was just huge. Clambered up these stairs, got into my office, sat down on this couch, and then just sat there. You've seen them on the buses. She literally had two Safeway bags filled with things, all sorts of things, and her purse would always be on the top on one of the bags. And she just sat there for a long while, and then she started to cry, and I asked her, and she could barely talk. And I'd listen, and I'd try to understand her, and then finally, I'd been doing children's theater. We began a process. She just acted out for me what had happened, and I got the story by the end of it. It took us an hour. She'd gotten on the bus to come to a strange part of town where I was. The fare was 25 cents. She put 35 cents into her. And she felt that the driver had yelled at her for being stupid. You know, lady, it's only 25 cents, you dummy. And she was appalled at being seen and humiliated. And was still very upset about it. Well, you know, my first session with this woman, I just had a feeling that what she really needed was somebody just to witness her. The last thing in the world this woman needed was somebody to push her around. And hypnosis did not seem the ticket for this woman. You make these intuitions. And I mean, I couldn't even get a case history from her. It took me a whole hour just to hear how she got to my office by bus. And I met with her for a year. I noticed her speech patterns picked up a little clearer. I got one dream from her. Got the story. Her mother was the daughter of a wealthy Tidewater family down in Virginia, South Carolina, and her mother had been somehow kind of developmentally disabled. And they did what wealthy people did. They sent her to a fashionable closet where they warehoused her, where she met her father, who was the son of a fairly well-to-do industrial family in the Northeast, where he'd been developmentally disabled. They warehoused him in the same closet. And people thought they'd just disappear. Well, they became adults. They fell in love. And they left the center and started a family, much to the center's resistance, tried to convince them they needed to be institutionalized the rest of their life. Well, I had no contact with these two families. And they raised a daughter and two sons, and then they died early because they got huge and overweight and stressed and heart attacks. And so by the time this woman came to me, she was living in a shelter with her two younger brothers who were driving her crazy because she was playing mama. Not only was she ridiculed by the outer world, and had terrible days in the sheltered workshop. She'd come home at night and had to be responsible for these two dependent male brothers of her. Her life was really hell. This woman had very little relief. So she dreamed of this huge house that had empty room after empty room after empty room. And in the dream, she was trying to get to her mother. And she could never find her mother in this giant empty house. My guess is she could never find anything animate. That big empty house, I had this hypothesis. I mean, who knows? The empty house was the way she felt about her soul and her psyche. The space she lived in was not animated. She couldn't find anybody animated, even her mother. She lived in a big empty box, and nobody cared about it. A year almost to the day, one day she came in, and I'm going to show you the drawing. She had her purse, and it was a piece of notebook paper, and clipped in the piece of notebook paper was this drawing hanging out that she had the Safeway sack turned so that it just stood hung right in my face. Waiting for me to notice. All that kind of thing. And so we went on for about 20 minutes talking about things, and finally I could not bear not noticing anymore, and I said, looks like you got something new there today, Barbara. And she kind of beamed, and she said, well, I had a dream. She knew that would please me. So, you know, clients get to kind of gain on it. They know how to give them, you know, if I was a behaviorist, they give you behavioral kind of techniques. If you're, you know, you've done, you know, incidentally, it's humbling. You know, all of the analytic studies, outcome studies, even today, it's empathy. It doesn't make any difference whether you work with dreams or behavioral. Those therapists that really witness and care about the self, I think, and people are the ones that provoke change. But studies are kind of universal. You know, we fight so much about technique, but I don't think it makes a difference whether you're a Methodist analyst or Roman Catholic Freudian. It doesn't make any difference. It's the empathy. But here's the image. And she had a dream that she went into this large undercroft, and this is a woman, realized that said she had moronic intelligence. Her speech pattern gave up. She goes, I had a dream, and I was in the undercroft of a Gothic cathedral. And I think this was a little bit Norman architecture. And I said, could you run that by me again? You know, it's got a little bit such. Don't worry about it. It's just a type of architecture, Terry. That's all she just said. Just don't worry about it. That's about the dream. So I didn't worry about it. So we move on to the end of this undercroft. Just want you to notice that I believe that it was a primal, a trauma of her own inner child that knew to stay hidden for years until she got into a witnessing space that things could start being revealed. She said at the end, I got to the end of this and there was a woman. You see this woman, it's a nun. This is a Lutheran, a nominal Lutheran as a kid. But there's this nun at the end that tells her, it's okay, Barbara, come ahead. And that's the end of the dream. Now, we don't have a lot of time, but, you know, I'd have you all, you look at that, one of the things that's most noticeable to me is there are bodies within bodies within bodies within bodies. And notice that where the nun stands closest to is the innermost body. My feeling is that that dream was a spontaneous constellation of the self and the journey of individuation that came to that woman. And she was so enchanted by it, she had to get a piece of notebook paper from work and immediately sketch it. She'd not drawn since she got only through the eighth grade since she'd been in school. And she'd been humiliated for drawing. And she just drew this and sketched it on a piece of notebook paper. That was on the obverse end of the notebook paper. We're trying to build up the image here a little bit. Or maybe you had to take the backside up. How's that? So there's the image. Next, well, you know, I thought it was a fluke. That's kind of interesting. She says, it's a gift for you, Terry. So she gives it to him. Next week she comes in and there's a bunch of them folded under the clasp of her purse, hanging just in front of me, waiting to be noticed. I asked right at the beginning of the hour. I figured, what the... it's backwards. We'll come back to this one. She had a dream. Notice the dimensions are still pretty primitive. It was kind of like Thornton Wilder's Our Town or Edgar Lee Masters' Spoon River Anthology. This was the family graveyard in New England. And these are all of the people, Uncle George and Aunt Albert, people she'd never met but heard stories and seen pictures of. They're getting out of their grave and starting to talk. And you notice they kind of look like Mr. and Ms. Tooth Decay in these pictures. They don't look like tombstones, but they're... And notice the barrenness, the stark barrenness of the trees in this world are barren and winter-like. It's really important because you're going to see a shift. She's going to drop down Alice's proverbial rabbit hole. And she comes into the church, and if you can see it, color begins to appear. And you notice that she went out and got some blank paper, and if you can't see them, I'll describe these images, and got where now there's some brown images. It looks, it's a church, but it really looks like a courtroom. And she says, old Uncle Albert, who was my father's brother that got him sent to the school, he's going to come in and give the sermon, and the text for the sermon that day is we're all sinful and we're all going to hell. I mean, kind of a nice, good, kind of a, that was probably the family mythic sermon. And she certainly believed that. That's what she believed about herself. That she was damned in some way to not having any living experience. And she says, look, you see how big she is in the front? You see this huge black image. That's her self-image. And she says to me in the dream, she says, I'd heard this enough times that I knew there was nothing interesting in here, any more interesting for me. I'm going downstairs again. So she goes into the undercroft. And this is where this image. And she says, it's a Gothic cathedral again. It's more Romanesque this time, Terry. And again, I asked. And she says, type of architecture. Don't worry about it. It's Romanesque. So we're walking down, we're walking down these Romanesque aisles. We come to the end. And here is a square frame, and there's no person this time, but if you can't see it in the back, there's a bright yellow light. And the bright light has a male voice that says, it's okay, Barbara, come ahead. And all of the great religious craft guilds, Masonic, Knights Templar, women's mystical guilds, there often is a moment in these great traditions where before the great rituals, often the liturgist will look to the person and say, what do you seek? You're often barefooted and you're wearing white. And the initiant's response is, in German it used to be mehr Licht. In fact, people said this, what Goethe said on his deathbed, more light, more light. What do you seek? More light. The light of the self. I think this woman knew what she sought. Now, watch this. Only a week, folks. It's amazing the tutelage of the unconscious as it claims the central nervous system. She comes in with that drawing 1 week later. Notice that you see the blockingness of the perspective and look at just what happens in a week. And she's gone out and got crayons now. And she says, I had a dream that I was in a railroad tunnel, and it was a nightmare, and I woke up terrified, and she started to shake and cry because she said, I'm so big, there won't be enough room for the engine and me in this tunnel. So, remember, I'd been doing kind of a modification of children's theater analysis with this woman. And so she was used to doing weird things, like walking around my office and having us see things that nobody else could see. As June Singer says in her latest book on kind of Gnostic or Jungian stuff, the invisible world can only be seen by those that have eyes to see and ears to hear. Well, we were seeing the invisible world. So I said, well, you know, why don't we kind of take a walk? And so we start taking a walk in my office. And I let her describe to me what changed. The rails let out. We went to the dark end of the tunnel. We found a side tunnel, and the rails went out. She later went home and got watercolors and painted this and brought it in next week. This is called active imagination and Jungian jargon. You know, we're vivifying a live image in the office. And she gets narrow and narrow. And one of the things she does, she had never touched me. It was very touching. Think about equivocation. This is a woman here who's this really educated, white, patriarchal male. And this really heavy, poor, moronic, forgotten woman. I mean, what a cultural and gender-based contrast. But she gently grabs my head one time and pushes it down and says, the ceiling gets low and I don't want you to get hurt. She did that. That's the first time she did this. We're getting down, so we get to the bottom, and she starts to cry, and she says, the first time I think she's ever had anybody witness the level of despair in her, she says, I'm at a dead end. It's just like my body. It's dead. There's no way out. So I say, well, let's just sit down. The secretary knows that we're in here. If we're in here too long, she'll call the National Guard. She's a good friend of that, was active in it. They'll find us. But let's wait. So we wait and see what happens. And all of a sudden she goes, ah! And she looks, oh, incidentally, just, you know, look, think about the caves at Lascaux or Altamira, the Paleolithic caves, ceremonial caves. Don't these look like a ritual cave? She's painting her own psychic art. And I look like kind of, sometimes they look like sperms and eggs too. There's this kind of spermatozoic, great images of Eros. And she says, my goodness, there's an opening. Ta-da! And we're just sitting, there it is. And I see it too. And then she gets really depressed. She says, I'll never get up, I'm too big. And I said, well, I'll help you. And I worked in an office where we had some windows all across one wall that looked out in a courtyard that nobody usually ever used. So I kept my windows open. But this was in the day when we were all beginning to get a little worried about body contact and malpractice. Some of you in a therapist knew that there was an era where we all got concerned about touching clients. So here I am, we're climbing this imaginary wall, and suddenly she stops and she's sweating and groaning, and she says, I can't go any farther. And she says, I got in a hole and I'm stuck. I can't get through. And she starts to cry. And all of a sudden she said, I thought you said you were going to help. And I did. She says, well, and comedic relief. She says, well, push, dummy. That was her. So, malpractice. I'm imagining, what will I do in a court of law explaining? And then, Dr. Gibson, you got under this woman and you were pushing her through this imaginary hole. Yes, Your Honor. And I was not touching her inappropriately. I was very gingerly touching her posterior and pushing. So, I'm here. And we're pushing, and she's groaning. And she goes, I pop through. And she looks around, and she says, there's nobody home, but it's an Elizabethan village, I think. Elizabethan Tudors architecture. Don't worry about it. She says, don't worry about it. Walks around. Then, remember, we're standing side by side. But the power of the psyche, that she reaches down again, this tenderness, and says, do you need some help? And she pulls me up into this other world. And there's a road there, and we walk along the road and look at what happens in this other world. Evergreen, a road with a clear bifurcation. You say conscious, unconscious, male, who knows, but it's there. And we walk along this road, and it takes, oops, it's out of order. Well, the image is not there. I'll tell you about it. I spilled this tray a month ago, and I haven't got them back in order. The road takes a 90-degree bend, and there's a round little lake, and we stop there and dip our feet in the lake, and that's where the session ends, with us dipping our feet in the unconscious, in this new world of kind of verdancy and color. Next week she comes in, she says, I dreamed that this road, this natural road appeared, and it was this giant, black, transparent stone on the road. And I knew that if I concentrated on that stone and I took the stone into my heart, the stone would break apart and show me the way to go on the road. You think about the sacredness of stones. You think about every time in our Judaic tradition, whenever an Israeli man or woman had a powerful vision of Bethel or El Sharim or El Shabak, they would go there, and the thing they would do when you had a vision at night, you put a pile of rocks to honor it. Stones are divine. The Acropolis is a giant piece of stone. All the great cathedrals have a foundation stone and always have the world, the Omphalos, the world divine stone, the navel of the world. You go to Delphi or Epidaurus, or you go to Thebes, stones, and most of all the black Kaaba stone in the Islamic tradition, stones hold the mystical truth. My wife and I do a co-ed male sweat lodge that some Lakota friends of ours have encouraged us to do. And as you know, you heat these stones. And you bring them into the four direct, and they are alive when they come in glowing into that darkness. And you can't help but love the power that's in the stones. And when you put steam on them, the flute plays. It's incredible, the power, the spiritual soul power of the stone. And what is it the alchemists say? We're always trying to get the lapis or the philosopher's stone. We're trying to produce the stone of the true mystical knowledge of the Imago Dei. And this stone blows apart. And I want you to notice, look at these trees. They're just there. And as we go along, they're all green and wholesome. The road's natural now. It's not even concrete. Look at the roots going into the earth. The stone's breaking apart. Look at that. And she gets to the last thing. And this is where she dreams. She goes to sleep in her dream. And when she wakes up, there's this flowering rose on her left side. And the flowering rose seems to tell her in its fragrant sweetness in the dream that everything is going to be okay, Terry. And you may have heard about Gautama falling asleep under the Bodhi tree and waking up in the flower of the fivefold path, and the consciousness and the meaning of suffering occurred to him. Next week she comes in, this guy appears. And she says, this is Julius Caesar. And she says, no, it's Hercules. She gets her myth a little confused here. But think about the collective objective unconscious, the collective, all these repository of energy. She says, this is Hercules, and he wants to help the poor. And he comes to me in my dream, and he tells me I live in this room without any windows, and I need to take all of these paintings I've been doing for you in drawings and hang them on the walls in this room, and I can look through these paintings and really see the outer world for the first time in my life. And I say, well, who is this guy? And she said, well, I don't know. He's about 28. He's got brown hair, about 6'2". And I said, you know, anybody's 28, brown. I said, oh, no, transference was this rife here. You know, I'm standing here 28, brown. But notice, guy's got a great upper animus build on him, or other build, but look, the feet look still crippled. The grounded stance is, if you were doing Aikido with this guy, he'd be a pushover. But the problem gets solved in 1 week. Who do you think it's this, by the way? Have any fantasies about who this is? It is Robin Hood. She has a dream that she's walking through Sherwood Forest. Robin Hood sweeps down and grabs her all of her 340 pounds of glory, like she's just a feather, swings her up and puts her in a tree and says, and when I explained to her what I was doing, you get this kind of cold sense that she knew I was incompetent and I was never going to get another referral again from this woman. And finally they gave up on work and they did the behavioral. They brought the bottom up. They told this woman, if you don't lose 5 pounds a week, you're going to lose your place in the sheltered workshop and you're going to lose your government support. We're going to kick you out in the cold world. She got scared. She started to cry at her station that day. They told her that. And then she'd been reading the paper. Another thing I discovered is a woman reads the newspaper every day. And she knew about the new Civil Rights Commission in Boston. And the woman headed it up. And she got angry. She said, I just got angry at lunch. And I walked down to City Hall, and I walked in, and this woman saw me and said I could file a complaint for discrimination. And that week, that woman, she filed a complaint. They got the head of the sheltered workshop and her in a room and said, you can't do this to this woman. It's discrimination. She can be as heavy as she wants to be and stay here and get government funds for as long as she wants to. She meets the criteria. And she was telling me this story behind her shopping sacks, and her hands were on her hips just like this. Just like this. You're unconscious. And notice the stance, the psychic stance that comes from that sense of power. This woman is ready for battle now. And the final set, and that she did many more, but in this image, she dreamed that a mama salmon, a daddy salmon, and a baby salmon got stuck in the wrong stream for 30 years, and they finally found the way out, and she was sitting on this stone, and they were going to finally get out to the ocean, and she said, close to the dream by saying, and finally have a life for themselves. Within 2 weeks, she kicked her brothers out, said, you guys have got to find life on your own. And I get Christmas cards from her. She left the sheltered workshop. During this time, she lost, by the way, we weren't paying any attention to it, she lost the first 22 pounds of her adult life. She never did become skinny by her standards, but she got down to 200, a comfortable 200 pounds for her. Went to community college, got an AA degree, and is now working as associate director of one of the sheltered workshops. One of the things I discovered, every Saturday, this woman read her way through whole sections of the public library. Read her way through the ancient history sections, the art history sections. This woman was alive. But nobody had ever provided her a space where that life, she could even know it and could be fully witnessed to and it could get moving again. And the mama salmon and the baby salmon and the papa salmon that are stuck could begin to get back and go to their life again. We don't have a lot of, in fact, we're probably at the, what time, is it the witching hour? I was going to put a chart up here. I'll just tell you what I was going to say. I was going to have you all guess at this stuff. But the Gnostics. The Gnostics said that we live in a material fallen world. The Gnostics said that these archons or these evil powers have claimed the attention of the world and they're distracted with material corporal life and they no longer see the divine spirit in it. And in the Valentinian image, the one person who had compassion for this was the feminine side of the Godhead, Sophia or Barbella, who, out of her compassion, lost her own balance and fell through the 30 tiers of this darkness. But because the world cared about her and she was divine, there was a horon or a limit that caught her at the 13th level. And from there, there was a kind of a safety net. And from there, she could observe and see all of the splinters of divine light that still were in the material, dark, lost world. And she was calling out to those splinters and giving them guidance about how to ascend back to the wholeness of soul and spirit, masculine and feminine. And she is the voice, I think, of the psyche. And I think Jung found her as the voice of the self that's still caught in this world, calling us to a greater wholeness and completion and power. And I think this woman was in the 13th level and got aware of the divine sparks inside herself. And that kind of mystical, and you can label all of those. You could see mandalic images in there and quaternary images and animus images and you could see shadow images. But it's clear that that was a complete set of a mystical individuating experience that was so powerful to that woman that she felt compelled to draw it and to bring it into literal birth into this world, to have the spiritual world meet the material world, and she could see the mystical completion of her own wholeness and hold it in her own hand. And that's the task. Does somebody turn the front lights on? Somebody got a switch there. Just close with this quote, and then some people always ask about bibliography, so I'll put up a couple of quick bibliography sheets, and then we're out of here. This is just a closing quote from Stephen Holler about Jungian work and Gnostical and mystical reclamations that Jung made for us. The untransformed human being, that's all of us, exists in a world where the opposites are fiercely and hopelessly entangled in each other's conflictual embrace. Was your Monday like that for you today? I was in the conflictual embrace today. It is only by rising above the opposites that the spiritual perspective of true gnosis, true knowledge, and gnosis is not knowledge of the head, it's not patriarchal left brain knowledge. Gnosis is knowledge of the heart, gnosis cardias, knowledge of the heart and observation of the heart. Only by rising above the opposites that the spiritual perspective of true gnosis arises, by inducing an experiential knowledge of things transcendent, the knower becomes increasingly affinitized to transcendence and becomes able to realize the hitherto hidden divinity within themselves. And that's what happened to this woman. Somebody provided a space, where they, a compassionate witnessing to the conflict of the opposites and the oppression that she had suffered was there. And she could rise above that in play and in humor and in sorrow and realize the transcendence that lived within herself. And that gave her the possibility to get moving with her life. She didn't have to stay and hide out in sheltered workshops and take a lot of abuse for the rest of her life. People always ask, what kind of books, where can I go? These are all fairly fast-paced. I've got multiple big routes. I just want to talk about some of my favorite. If you want to learn more about alchemy, and they weren't trying to turn lead into gold, the real alchemists, they were trying to get this lapis, this philosopher's stone. Edwin Ettinger's Anatomy of the Psyche is wonderful. I think it's the best thing out. It's the most readable, 1985. It may even be out on the table out there. For those of you that are interested, I talked to a couple people before the break interested in the Judeo-Christian tradition and Jungian. Robert Moore has edited two of the best collections of the classic papers on relating theology and Jungian psychology. The first one was Carl Jung and Christian Spirituality in 1988. Both are from Paulist. And that was such a success. It's great articles in everybody from John Doerly to Anne Belford Uhlenhoff to Bianchi. Some really nice articles. Did a second volume with Meckel, Jung and Christianity and Dialogue from Paulist in 1990. I wanted to put for those interested in Jung and mysticism, there's a guy, I've never met him, some of you may, he lives down in Crater Lake, Oregon, and puts out these kind of, self-publishes these books that are really nice, James Arage, Christian Mysticism in the Light of Jungian Psychology, and he just published, crank these out, it's some kind of crater, he's also got a dictionary of Jungian stuff out now, he's kind of, I've never met him, I don't know any analyst or anybody's run across him. But he exists there, or he's a nom de plume for some chipmunk. Joseph, it's Campbell with a P after Joseph Campbell, The Mystic Visions, papers from the Aronosh Yearbook and the Yearbooks. Wonderful, some of the best translated. You know, Jung, he sat around this glass table down with Phoebe Crepton and her gang, and Campbell and Wolfgang Pauli, the physicist, and Mircea Eliade, some of the greatest minds met, and wrote these wonderful papers. And if you really like mystical literature, the papers, they're deep and they're difficult, but they're wonderful. That's out in paper. Probably get that. Elliot Bay loves Jungian stuff, and if they don't carry it, the university bookstore probably will. Edward Ettinger, The Bible and Psyche, he writes a lot of stuff. He's really interested in this mystical side of our experience. Symbolism in the Old Testament. And Evelyn Underhill is a classic author on mysticism, and I think she has a real Jungian flavor to her. And then Edward Ettinger, Anatomy of the Psyche again, but Adam McLean, The Rosary of the Philosophers, one of Jung's classic alchemical texts he was most fascinated with, was this the Philosophorum Rosarium, woodcuts about this kind of king and queen that get naked and get into a giant psychic hot tub and die and are reborn a couple of times. It's a fascinating set of images. And incidentally, McLean, they're coming out in retranslation now, Faunus Press has a wonderful translation of all of the alchemical greats. They're bringing them out one paperback volume at a time. But if you're really interested in the alchemical stuff and readable current translation, go to your bookseller, the Faunus Press, get the address. They'll mail you the brochure on their alchemical series, The Solar Splendus. All of the classics are coming out. And Adam McLean's one of the big editors for that. Faunus, Phaunes. And then some of you are always interested in how can I learn more about applying some of this stuff to couple and family work. Well, object relations, couple therapy, these are psychoanalysts. But for some of you who are therapists and want to look at projective identification dynamics from a depth perspective, this is an excellent book. Then couple it. I don't have it up here, but, well, yes, I do. Polly Young Eisendrath, colleague, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia area, has written a book called Hags and Heroes, A Feminist Approach to Jungian Psychotherapy with Couples. That's a nice introduction. And I just recently have got a splendid, if any of you know the journal Harvest, it's a British Jungian journal, Renes Papadopoulos, South African Greek analyst, working in London, has a wonderful article on family therapy and alchemical and archetypal connections. It's just brilliant. And it was like the 1990 version of Harvest. Does the Jung book, you all in the Jung book collection, do you get Harvest here? So it's in it. It's a wonderful article from Papadopoulos about family therapy applications of archetypal stuff. So we could go all night, but thank you. I'd be happy to stay, answer some questions, but feel free to leave. We're near the end of time, and it's been a nice night. Thank you.